beginning with Bishnayahu, who was head of the department, let's see, for 94 until 2002, right?
Yeah.
Bish.
Thank you, Joe. And well, I think I'm going to congratulate you and Pedro for hosting this and for celebrating a major initiative that I think is worthy cause for us to celebrate, because it really went through a period of change. Now, when Joe asked me, Bish, you have to say something, so I'm thinking, like, what will I say? And it's a story. It's a historical story about what happened. And when you ask somebody in historical story to tell a story, there are ways of telling a story. And what I want to do with you this afternoon is to tell a story at three levels. And the three levels are, one is very classical, individuals who are involved. And it's very, in popular literature, it's often the focus on individuals. So they'll say, let's talk about Joe Ferreira, and Joe Ferreira was doing, so it's Joe or Pedro or individuals. The second level of story is often the organization within which they perform. And thus it's the DASP as an organization, the MIT as an organization. They often influence actually what we do. So it's not just individuals that make up a story, it's individuals within an organizational setting. And to make the story even more complicated, it's in the larger political economy of the moment, which is Pedro's idea, right? Pedro believes in that strongly because he comes out of the anti-fascist tradition in Portugal. So the three levels, individuals, organizations, and larger political economy, in a good story, you show the interaction between the three, right? That's a good story. And so I don't have the time to do all three, but I will give you, I just want you to keep the time so that I don't go beyond, because I want to hear both Larry and also Iran's version of the story. So just to give you a quick look on what was happening. In a story also, when you tell a story, or at least in a social science discipline, not a fiction, you often give the positionality of the narrator. And in case I see myself as narrating that history from 1994 or to 2002 when I was department head, and for you to understand the story, you have to understand my positionality, where I was coming from at that moment intellectually. And I come out, my PhD is from UCLA, which is a planning school that was, I think, totally opposite to MIT's intellectual priorities at that moment. And there's a long history why that happened. Because my advisor, who was denied tenure at MIT, John Friedman, went back and took his revenge in creating a school that is so different from MIT. And in which way? The first thing that you said, this is linked to our story, is the whole school of UCLA, created in 1969, was based on the notion that traditional planning of cities and planning of nations have completely failed. The modernization attempts, economic modernization, which is industrialization, political modernization, which is Western-style democracy, social modernization, and spatial modernization, none of them have worked at all. And one assumption in that story of modernization is technological change. If you don't believe in modernization, you think nothing has worked, you also dismiss technological change. Technological change actually was considered to be in UCLA at that time. There was, of course, no course on that. But the argument was that technology was the problem. MIT technology is a solution, right? And where did this idea of technology as a problem come from? It came from originally basically critique of technical reason. If you look at the Frankfurt School, which heavily influenced the faculty at UCLA, people like Hochheimer, Adorno, others who from the Frankfurt School, in which technology and technocratic thinking was considered to be terrible. And what's the opposite of technocratic thinking? Political, right? Political thinking. So we have a political thinking to rethink the development paradigm completely, etc. So I came out of that tradition when I came to MIT. And So when I first came, I realized it's not that the department was very technocratic, but there was more openness to technology. And then in 1984 I came, and then I met Joe Ferreira. And I'm somebody who's very enthusiastic about technology in the program. And there was not that many people, but Joe was there at that time. Sort of, I thought that was the person who people relied on. Don Schoen, who headed the department a few years before me, and who died, and we have a book with him. Don Schoen was somewhat more familiar with technology, or at least sympathetic to the idea that technological change is a very important thing to understand. It's not something you don't dismiss it. And he came out of private sector. In private sector in 1970s, technological change was a very big factor that was shaping private industry in the way it works. And Don was trying to understand that. He wrote the book Beyond the Stable State. And if you read the Beyond the Stable State, one major line of thinking is technological change. So Don was receptive to that. I think he was more receptive than many others in the department. But there were other four groups who were created: international development, set up a city design, EPP, environmental policy, and also housing community development. There was no group called technology in the city or information technology in the city. So Joe and the computer resource lab that was created was to just serve these other four areas. It was supposed to be a servicing function, but not an autonomous intellectual idea that could be flourished on its own. That was the difference. It was from, and that's why it's such a major achievement, I think, on their part, to turn something from a servicing aspect to making it a central part of intellectual thinking. That's the journey, right? So in that mode, I just want to say, so when Don, and I have to go through very quickly, touch some point. Don was instrumental in bringing Lina Wiggins, and John, Lina Wiggins and Joe Ferreira made a small team. We had four, five, six faculty in each of these areas, right? They had two, but they consistently brought more money. And I remember in faculty meeting, Don Schoen would say, well, we have money now raised by Lina, somebody called Lina and Joe, or Joe and Lina, the term was to me, right? And so we thought, okay, they're raising money, but are they doing something interesting? Nobody even asked that question. We just thought that they're servicing the other departments. Now, when I became 94, the department had, before me, just like 1988 or 89, we had a change of regime at the dean's office. John DiMancio, who was a designer par excellence, John DiMancio stepped down and replaced by Bill Mitchell. William Mitchell, who wrote the book City of Bits and wrote actually two or three volumes of this on the same topic, he came in late 88, 89. He was at Harvard. He was brought in from Harvard, and I remember he telling me he only came because Charles Vest, who was our president at that time, promised him, saying, I will give you a free hand. You shape the program. Because Bill Mitchell had worked a lot on information technology in UCLA. He was actually at UCLA in architecture department when I was a student there. I remember taking his course. So he comes in, and he starts, first of all, he had his agenda, technology. And he wanted to shape the school in that mode. First thing I remember, I was a junior faculty. All faculty members got free computers, personal computers, because he wanted everybody to communicate with him through email, which he thought was more efficient than meeting him individually. So he starts this thing, and I realized in talking to him that this was his agenda. Now I'm department head, and I have to work with the dean. You know that if you work with the dean, that resources are there. Your department-wise, you don't have that much resources, but the dean has a lot more discretionary funds, etc. So then he told me that he's working on this issue, and what should we do? So I said, okay, I like the idea of creating a subgroup called Technology in the City. We were the first planning school to actually make an attempt to saying, let's create something called Technology in the City. Now it's a new group, we need more faculty, just Joe and Lina had by that time left, I think by the time I began department, she had got a job at Rutgers or something. Rutgers. Hmm? Yeah, she had left. So what is this going to be? It's an effort at building this group, a cluster of faculty with a critical mass that can push for an intellectual agenda and not just be a servicing arm to the rest of the department. So we talked to Bill Mitchell, and I realized that Bill's optimism that this is a powerful thing that's happening, this is going to shape the whole world, that there was a lot of people like Lisa Peedy, for example, who's an anthropologist, who are very skeptical of these positive things. And Lisa comes from this anti-technology movement also, and also sort of a kind of anarchism that also is anti-technology. So we needed a conversation. I thought it was important to create a conversation within the department to create the support that we need to generate to create this group and create some new faculty slots. And the dean was behind the moment. So I thought this is the perfect time because he is supporting, he has the money. So I told him, I think that'll be nice. Why don't we do a seminar series, weekly seminar, and we invite people on both sides, both pro and anti and technology within MIT, and we create a conversation and see what intellectual agenda emerges from that conversation that the group can actually be built on. And so there was a book that came out of it that I see Pedro also had. It's called High Technology and Low Income Communities. Now, low income communities was bread and butter of DASP, HCD. The people in HCD, they talked about small low income communities, right? So I had to juxtapose the two opposing things in a way to say, let's have a conversation. How can this high technology be used for low income communities? Right? Because if it was not for low income communities, many faculty would have said, this is not for us. Why are we doing this? Let engineering do this kind of things. We are about making the city a better place, small communities, etc. So this, and I asked Don Schoen at that time, and Don had, I think, just retired. Don had retired and he had more time. So I told Don, can you take the lead in creating this seminar series? Of course, I'll participate. And he asked a range of people, including Joe, including a couple of them, Don himself, actually. He couldn't finish the book. Actually, that's why the book is dedicated to him, because he died by the time you're finishing the book. It's a very interesting collection of people, Gary Marx, Gene Bamberger, Bruno Trudeau. I mean, varied vision of things. While we were doing these things, I realized that we have to move also on hiring more faculty. Otherwise, this is not going to go anywhere. Joe alone cannot run this whole thing. So I told Bill, do you have any names? We are not even thinking of a search at that moment. So he said, I have a person in mind from Cambridge University Beach. Why don't you check him out? And if you like him, I will find the money to bring him. I said, okay, who is that person? Carlo Ratti. From Carlo Ratti, who came for a meeting. And you know, Carlo is like veg and thin and everything. And I met with Carlo, and I realized that Carlo and Bill Mitchell had a lot in common. Lot in common. And they both, of course, they had also education in England in some ways. Carlo Ratti comes with this very clear idea what he wants to do. He was not interested so much in sort of building the team. He had it, so he wants a sensible city lab. He wants to use that technology for running the city, for identifying problems, etc. Very specific things he wanted to do. And he was able to raise money. He was very successful in raising money from various different sources. So here comes Carlo at that moment. Carlo Ratti comes at that moment. That by that time was almost near end of 2000. But what I want to say about is how the political economy was changing also at the same time. When 1994, when I took over, who was the president? Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had the most optimistic vision of how the country could reinvent itself out of using this new technology. Information technology is going, he called it the third new industrial revolution that's going to come. We're going to change the way we function, the way we work, etc. Very positive note. Let me add one other thing about the people. I mentioned the setting, the people and organization. As Bill is trying to, because Bill was very busy as a dean, but he wanted somebody to put pressure on him in a nice way to be able to write. And he told me, once we met over lunch, and he told me, do you know Manuel Castells? I said, yes. As a matter of fact, I know, because Manuel Castells was directing the dissertation of my wife. He was at Berkeley at that time, Manuel. I said, I know Manuel. Manuel was writing three major volumes for the end of the century. City of Beats, no, what was the thing?
Informational City.
So, informational city, etc. So we again, I said, okay, let's call Manuel. Why don't you ask Manuel to come and spend 3 months? Do you think I would have had the money as a department head to do? No. But Bill had. Bill had the money, right? So I asked Bill, can you support Manuel Castells? Yeah. Okay, no problem. And because that was his agenda. He wanted Manuel here so that Manuel and he could jointly write something that is going to kind of completely change the landscape at that moment. So Manuel had come here, and to just a digression, Manuel is supposed to speak in the morning. There's a big group of people, and we had one of our doctoral student who was supposed to be in charge of helping Manuel. And this doctoral student is now was teaching at UCLA. Now he become dean of Virginia Tech. Malo is in Virginia, no? So we are all waiting for the speaker to come. Where is Manuel? Where is Manuel? And then Malo comes to me and said, "Beach, he got hurt last night. A whole TV fell on him." Somebody who's talking about technology.
He was talking about the social impact of
social
technology.
Social impact. Whole TV fell on him. And I said, "Oh my God!" But anyway, it's a long story. Make a long story short. So Manuel was here that the whole end of the century. And that's coming near to the end of my term. But I want to say that a few things that strikes me now, looking back. One is that we had no idea. I didn't have idea how quickly this technology is going to change, how fast this is changing. Nobody at that time there's not a single article on artificial intelligence. Then look at what artificial intelligence is now. Everybody is talking about artificial intelligence, right? So the pace of change, the pace of technological change, I don't think we had an idea about what that pace of change is going to be. The second thing that happened is that 2001, you have September 11th, which is a major, major blow to the nation's pride in every way. It also opens up the use of technology for surveillance. So it was a very interesting twist, something of a technology that Manuel had written is going to democratize the world, right? And everything is going to open up and you're going to communicate with each other. By the time I'm stepping down, of course that Trump hadn't come at the president at that moment, but look at the conversation, how technology's impact on democracy is now and what it was in the 1990s. It's a big difference. Big difference on the kind of worry that this technology is actually anti-democratic in many ways. Look at none of those big guys were there, Bozos, they emerged after that, right? So the idea that three or four big guys are going to control this, it was also new. It came in the early 2000s. So the nature of the industry, how the industry and how people are making money out of it and creating inequality in the distribution of income, it was not in any, there's no piece in this book about that. That's also is a big shift. So if you look at the changes, as I said, mentioned again, individuals, I would say again, Bill Mitchell, and I do want to acknowledge Pedro. Pedro was a student, then a Spurs fellow, and he stayed, and he, in 2001, when this thing happened, he and Joe joined hands together to create the forum, first forum. And I want to say, it's funny that Joe mentioned the point about his politics, because it's always came to me because of his work in Portugal in the anti-fascist movement. He was always political. And I remember running a course. I used to teach a course. And I asked Pedro to come and speak. He brought his guitar. And at the end of the speech, he started singing the revolutionary song from Portugal, remember? And Ralph was
coming from Chile, actually.
And Ralph was sitting there thinking, like, what is this? This is supposed to be a graduate seminar. Anyway, so he played a big role, I would say, and maybe others I'm missing out for the moment. But again, I want to say, if you put the individuals, the organizational setting of DASP and MIT, which is a place for technology, and there was always support for that, and then the larger political economy of the shifting political economy from Bill Mitchell, from Bill Clinton and his optimism of technology to what we are seeing now, this kind of fear, again, the fear which many of our younger colleagues who are working on this issue now, on the science, social science, and planning, etc., they are always raising this issue of bias in artificial intelligence, etc. So that will be my story of what how I perceive the trajectory.
Thank you, Vish.
Thanks. That was 2002. The event occurred in 2003, which was the